Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money. Gorgeous blue sky day out there. The first day after most of the ski season, although PCMR will be going another week. This is Larry Warren, and Doug Wells is normally the co-host, but he is out enjoying the day today. And pleased to have Alex Butwinski in as a guest co-host today. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks, Larry. I'm glad to be here.
Well, very fine. And we have an interesting show for you to participate in today. First, we're going to speak with Adam Grant. And Adam Grant is very well known. He's been in the business world. He's a professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is a best-selling author, and we're going to talk about his New York Times bestseller, Give and Take, Why Helping Others Drives Our Success. So we'll have Adam on the line with us shortly, and then what else?
And then, Larry, we're going to talk to Tony Yapias, who's the director of And my Spanish is terrible, but it's the Proyecto Latina de Utah and small business, and he's a small business owner. And we're going to talk about Hispanic entrepreneurs, that they are the key driver of our community. And Latinos tend to be good examples of those, starting family businesses and working through becoming successful. And then after that, we're going to have Joel Clark in studio. And he's another entrepreneur who started out selling pancake mix out of a red wagon in Salt Lake City. And now his company, Kodiak Sales, is selling their original flapjack mix in over 7,000 stores. So he's a Salt Lake City All-American success story.
And based in Park City now. And he was just on the Shark Tank last week or a couple weeks ago, which is this TV show where entrepreneurs pitch their products to sharks. So we'll talk to him about that experience, and we will be back to start Mountain Money with Adam Grant after this.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is Craig McCarthy with the Park City Chamber Bureau. Do you know that members of the Park City Chamber Bureau have access to a wide array of benefits that give them an edge in the local marketplace? We offer members-only insurance and discount programs, business-to-business networking opportunities, and much more. Becoming a member of the Park City Chamber Bureau is a great investment for your business. Information on joining is online at visitparkcity.com or call us at 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization.
And welcome back to Mountain Money, and we have on the line with us Adam Grant now. And Adam is the youngest tenured professor and highest rated teacher at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. His consulting and speaking clients include Google, the NFL, Johnson & Johnson. Boy, it's just a who's who of the pillars of modern life. Pixar, Goldman Sachs, the UN, and the U.S. Army and Navy. So quite the credentials, and he's author of several New York Times bestsellers. His latest that we'll be talking about today is Give and Take, Why Helping Others Drives Our Success. Welcome to the program, Adam.
Thank you very much. Thrilled to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you. And what's wrong with the U.S. Marines? They apparently aren't taking your advice. Or maybe they're folded into the U.S. Navy category there.
Don't quote me on that.
Hey, this book is about really about leadership style. How best to lead by not just saying me, myself, and I all the time. And you really divide leaders, people into three categories: givers, takers, and matchers. Why don't you tell us a little bit about each?
That's right. So you can find these styles in any industry or any culture. People who are takers are typically the ones who are trying to get as much as possible from others, never want to give anything back. They're the leaders who hog credit for other people's accomplishments, who claim the interesting and important invisible work for themselves while pushing all the grunt responsibilities down the ladder. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, we have the givers. For me, a giver is not just a philanthropist or a volunteer, but rather the kind of person who enjoys helping others and often does it with no strings attached, sharing knowledge, providing mentoring, making introductions.
But
most
the way,
of us fall
but,
somewhere in the middle of this spectrum as matchers, and a matcher basically tries to keep an even balance of give and take. So if I do something for you, you do something for me.
So I presume, of course, that the givers are who you think we should all model ourselves to be. But I thought climbing the corporate ladder was all about climbing past everybody else.
Well, it's interesting. The evidence shows that the givers are typically the worst leaders as well as the best leaders. And so it's possible that, you know, if you end up being too generous or perhaps not being selective enough in who you help or what kind of help you give, you can get trampled by takers. But there's another group of givers who end up outperforming takers and matchers, and I think it's fascinating to learn from them and how they operate.
Yeah, Adam, it was actually fascinating to see that the givers are at both ends of the success ladder and how that can happen. And I was particularly fascinated by the idea of giver burnout and how the one gal managed to overcome that, the Teacher for America. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite stories I came across when doing the research for the book. I had lots of studies that looked at why givers burn out. And one of the consistent patterns is that givers don't burn out when they're giving too much, but rather they burn out when they're giving but can't see the impact that they're having. And the example of this that really struck me was Comrie Callahan, who is teaching for Teach for America. She was up till 1 a.m. often grading, then she'd be up at 6 a.m. the next morning to start her day, teaching in a really difficult school where the kids always misbehaved and never listened, and many dropped out or failed out. And one of the things she did was, on the weekend in her spare time, she started a nonprofit. It was a Philadelphia chapter of an organization called Minds Matter. And she's giving extra time. She's helping all these kids. And instead of exhausting her more, it actually energizes her. And she ends up becoming the longest tenured Teach for America teacher at her school and being nominated for a National Teaching Award. So how do you recover from burnout by giving more rather than less? Well, what she's doing over the weekends is she's actually helping a bunch of kids who are low income and disadvantaged but high potential. And she's able to remember through that experience that her teaching can really make a difference. And that energizes her in a way that carries over to her day-to-day responsibilities, which can be a little bit more of a drag.
So talk about the workplace itself. So a giver who is on his or her way up would seem to be in competition with all those around, and yet you're saying if you actually are helping those around you, all working toward the same goal, that if you're have the right skill set, will actually advance you as well.
That's right. It very much can. Of course, you have to be cautious when you're dealing with takers, because if you end up helping a bunch of selfish people, you're probably not going to benefit from that. But the evidence does show that across engineering, sales, medicine, whatever field you're in, that if you're smart about who you help and how you do it, that can actually work to your advantage. Of course, that can't be the reason for doing it, because then you're just a clever taker or matcher in disguise. But that, you know, consistently what happens is givers are actually able to undo competition. So if you're a taker, there are always other takers out there who are gunning for you. Whereas if you're a giver, people are cheering for you and rooting you on. And, you know, as the venture capitalist Rand Commissar is fond of saying, it's easier to win when other people want you to win.
Yeah, actually, it sort of sounds like we're moving into the faker category, which I guess Ken Lay was the example of in your book. And he managed to fool a lot of people. And I got the sense that he was the ultimate taker, but was able to pretend he was a giver.
Ken Lay being the chief of Enron.
Right.
Infamous Enron.
That's right. You know, if you trace through the Enron history, there are all these patterns that nobody picked up on of Lay sort of engaging in classic taker behavior of kissing up but kicking down, you know, doing favors for powerful people, donating 1% of Enron's profits to charity, creating this facade of being a generous spy, but then, you know, treating peers and those below him really poorly because he felt like, you know, it was less strategic and advantageous to help out people who could do him no good. Of course, eventually it caught up with him, but one of the questions I was fascinated by was, could we have spotted earlier on that he was a faker, which is probably the most dangerous kind of taker? If you go back to the 1997 Enron annual report, 4 years before the company collapsed, you will see there is a full-size photo of Ken Lay's head. And believe it or not, there's actually evidence. A couple strategy professors studied the size of CEO photos in annual reports and found that the CEOs with the largest photos were the ones who are most likely to be rated by Wall Street analysts as the takers, because, of course, that sends a message, it's all about me. And I think we need to pay more attention to those kinds of cues.
Yeah, absolutely. Being from the East, I tend to be cynical, and the theme that I ran, the Ken Lays of the world are the kind that, I would immediately be looking at and saying, is this guy a real giver? Is he an outright taker, or is he a faker? And I think the challenge becomes the identifying the pre-calculated motives of the person that you're trying to work with.
It does, but there's actually a way of getting around this problem in interviews, everyday conversations even, which is, what you'd ideally do is you'd ask people, here's a situation, what would you do? And then you'd be very careful if somebody chooses the taker response. But nobody's going to do that because no one wants to admit they're a taker. So the loophole is, instead of asking people, what would you do? You ask them, what do you think other people would do? So there's research, for example, suggesting that if you want to catch a thief in the hiring process, just ask, what percent of people do you think steal at least $10 worth of merchandise from their companies each month? And the higher somebody's estimate that other people are thieves, the greater the chances that person is a thief.
Huh. Interesting. Now, we've been talking about takers. Let's talk about a giver who's well-known in Utah, and I've known him for some time myself. I've even gone as far as Armenia with him on a relief trip. John Huntsman Sr., who, of course, went to the Wharton School and has been a large contributor, a large giver there. Talk about John Huntsman and his success. He gives the persona, because it's genuine, that he's just a supremely nice guy out to do good in the world, but in doing so, he's become fabulously wealthy.
Yeah, I was incredibly inspired by John Huntsman Sr.'s story, and the more I've read and the more I've heard, the more impressive it gets. It's obviously not a coincidence that he built the building that I teach in at Wharton. But one of the things that happened was when I was gathering stories to really bring out the principles that I had data for, I started asking people, who's the most generous person you've ever met in business? And just over and over again, Huntsman Sr.'s name came up. And, I think there are so many different examples that you could raise. A lot of them, of course, are in the philanthropy space of just how much he's given. But I think it's also striking that at the bargaining table, he's actually walked away from higher offers because of a handshake and said, yes, I know that you're willing to give me an extra $190 million, but we agreed on this deal 6 months ago at the original terms, and just because my company is worth more now while we're waiting for our legal teams to draw up the terms doesn't mean I should just accept more money from you. And I think that has obviously been reputationally powerful. I also, I was just struck recently, I had a reader of my book, a guy by the name of Zach Bales, write a letter to Mr. Huntsman just saying he admired his work and he was inspired by it. And he got a very nice personal letter back talking about how important it is to give and how much he appreciated hearing from a reader of Give and Take. And I thought that spoke volumes.
Yeah, the other part of that I found intriguing was the parallel beginnings between Ken Lay and Mr. Huntsman, that they both started out with nothing and worked their way up to being successful. And in Ken's case, to a point. The other interesting thing I found in the book was Stu Inman, the Blazers general manager, and how he might have been an overgiver, but in the end how that worked out. So maybe you can give us a sense of what he was about.
Yeah, I think Stu Inman is a story that's probably been misunderstood by almost everybody in sports. He was responsible for what have been known as probably two of the biggest draft busts in NBA history, one in the early 70s, picking Larue Martin as the number one choice.
Who?
And then, the even more notorious one would be choosing Sam Bowie, number two, over Michael Jordan. And, you know, you just look at that and you think, what a terrible decision maker. You overlook the fact, though, if that's where you stop, that Stu Inman built the Blazers championship team, which remains the only one in the Bill Walton era. And he did it with a bunch of really great steals of the draft who he chose late and went on to really add a lot of value that nobody else knew would be great players. And then he built that powerhouse team of the 80s with Clyde Drexler and Jerome Kersey. And if you dig into how Stu Inman judged talent, you see a couple things. First thing is, he wasn't just interested in your raw ability. He was actually looking for two critical characteristics, one which we would call grit. You know, are you tenacious? Do you have that persistence necessary to really develop to the fullest of your potential? And then secondly, he actually looked for players who were givers. He said, I'm not just going to, you know, to bring the lone star. I'm going to try to draft players who will put the team's best interest first. And even if that means letting go a little bit of the spotlight or, you know, not getting past the ball at every key moment, if I choose the players who are going to work the hardest and who are going to try to do what's best for the team, then ultimately that's going to be what puts the team first. And he did extremely well in a very small market with a pretty short amount of resources.
He did it pretty well in college as well, and I guess the way he ended his career. You mentioned those in the book as well.
Yeah, very much so. I think, you know, Stu Inman is a classic example of somebody who was always finding a diamond in the rough. And, you know, whether it was spotting, you know, players in college who didn't seem to fit the bill of what a traditional player ought to look like or play like, but watching, okay, do they have the tenacity and work ethic? Do they have the generosity to become great players? I think that's something we could all learn from.
Talk a little bit about... is there a difference in the sexes? I would think women, to cast a broad generality, are more nurturing and maybe more givers than takers. Is that the case, and does that work in their favor or against them in the workplace?
Well, I had the same prediction going in. When you look at the evidence, men and women are actually equally likely to be givers, but you see a couple of differences in those patterns. One is that women do more one-on-one relationship-based giving. Men do more giving toward groups in public. And, you know, I think that because most of the giving that matters in organizations is that behind the scenes, you know, I'm not hogging the spotlight sort of helping, we probably need more men to be acting like women. The question is then, okay, what are the consequences? And the evidence shows here, as many people have read in Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, women are less likely to get rewarded for giving than men. When men give, people are often surprised because of these stereotypes. It's like, gosh, he was so generous. I had no idea. Let's shower him with praise and rewards.
Exactly.
Yeah, whereas when a woman does it, it's like, well, we expected her to be caring, and you know, it's more likely to be taken for granted. But that's only half the story, because there's also evidence Tim Judge and his colleagues show that when you look at men and women who become doormats, the unsuccessful givers, men actually get punished more for that than women. It's like a violation of masculinity, right? You, not only were you unsuccessful, but you were really warm and caring. What a wimp! So, you know, if you put all that together, I think right now men are more likely to face extreme outcomes from giving. You know, the worst, the worst, and the best, the best. And women are more likely to avoid those extremes.
You know, we've got about 5 minutes left, Adam, and let's just have some fun here. There are lots of just kind of minor points that all lead to the larger point, I guess, but you've come up with some pretty interesting and startling, it's kind of like big data, how you crunch a lot of data and you come up with crazy conclusions, but the data supports them. Okay, so why do people named Dennis... are more likely than people named other names to become dentists?
This is a controversial finding. But
well, no kidding, yeah.
There is evidence from Brett Pelham and his colleagues that they've gone through all these naming data, and they do find that you are more likely to choose a career, a spouse, and even a city that resembles your own name. And that the logic seems to be that when we encounter a person or a place or a career that just unconsciously reminds us of ourselves, we're a little bit more interested and open and enthusiastic. And you play those decisions out over millions and millions of people, and you get a couple extra dentists and Denises who become dentists.
Okay, another one. You talk about why people buy the wrong wedding gifts for their friends. If they're their friends, they ought to know what they're buying.
If only it were that simple. This is research I love by Frank Flynn and Francesca Gino. What they show is that basically people prefer to get wedding gifts that are on their registries when they're receiving. But then when those same people turn around to give gifts, they try to give something unique because they think it's more thoughtful. Well, what's the most thoughtful gift? What I chose that I wanted. But you know, most of us have a hard time stepping out of our own preferences and getting into the shoes of the people we're buying for, and I think we need to remember that we should give what we want to receive, not necessarily give exactly what we think we would receive, but rather what the person signed up for in the first place.
That makes sense. How does the number of siblings we have affect our generosity? Can you tell us that?
The evidence that exists on this so far suggests that more siblings means more giving. If you grow up in a family where you have to do more sharing and caring, you're more likely to experience a little bit of sort of responsibility training. And then especially, it turns out, if you are not the youngest child, because the youngest child is the one who ends up receiving a lot of giving, but doesn't always have the experience of having to do it for younger children afterward.
Right. Here's another one. Why does a single picture lead radiologists to make more accurate diagnoses?
I had fun with this one. So Turner and colleagues in Israel give radiologists x-rays to scan. And in some of the cases, they give you the images as you'd normally get them. And then 3 months later, you're given the scan again, only there's a photo of a patient inserted with the file. When the radiologists just see the picture of the patient whose x-ray they're scanning, they actually achieve 46% higher diagnostic accuracy. And that seems to be driven by empathy, that when you look at an x-ray image that has the patient's face attached to it, this isn't just another image to scan, it's now a human being. And you spend a lot more time on the report, you write a longer, more detailed report, and you're more careful.
Wow, I'm going to insist on that.
just make sure you're really good looking.
Yes. How many of my x-rays have you looked at? Adam, you end the book with 10 action items for impact, and maybe you can give our listeners some of those and how that might help them in, become better givers.
Yeah, a couple recommendations. I think the first step is actually to figure out where you stand on the spectrum of givers, takers, and matchers. We have a free assessment on the giveandtake.com website for those who are interested. You can fill out a survey and find out whether you tend to think most like a giver, taker, or a matcher. But listeners know too much to do that honestly at this point. So I'd recommend the 360 assessment where, again, for free, the site will allow you to invite anyone you know to rate you anonymously, and then you get aggregated feedback on how other people see you. Try that one at your own risk. Another recommendation is just to gather a group of people, might be 8 to 10 at the fewest, could be a couple dozen, and run what's called the reciprocity ring from the Humax Corporation. What you do is you invite everyone to make a request, and then you challenge everyone else in the group to try to fulfill the request. It's got to be something you want or need, but cannot get on your own. And then you have access to the knowledge and networks of this whole group of people who are willing to give. It's a great way to get people in the habit of giving, but also in the habit of asking, which if nobody asks, it's really hard to know what to give. And when you gather a group of people to do this, you can see some really amazing requests get fulfilled. In my experience, about 80% of the requests, even the pretty difficult to fulfill ones, get some meaningful help. So I think that's a great activity to try out.
And actually, there's one other one that I was interested in, which was Tony Hsieh was the founder and entrepreneur of Zappos, was very complimentary of your book. And he's in the start a love machine category of how you can make an impact. And I found that rather intriguing, especially I'm sure you've been down there and witnessed the culture there, which was pretty astonishing for someone coming in from a more corporate environment. Tell us a little about that.
Well, the basic idea, Zappos, as well as others like Southwest Airlines and Google, have moved in the pure bonus direction in recent years to say, look, you know, a lot of times bosses don't see all of the critical acts of giving and helping that really matter in organizations. So why don't we give every employee a small budget so that they can recognize and reward people who go above and beyond the call of duty? And this has gone really well to the point where a company called Linden Lab that makes the Second Life virtual world created this love machine where they allowed software engineers across the company to send little e-cards whenever somebody had done something great just to recognize and reward them. And, you know, typically it would add about $3 to your paycheck. But the company ended up having this love leader list where you could find out, are you as loved as your colleagues? And lo and behold, you start to get a bunch of software engineers competing to see who could be the most helpful. I thought it was a pretty creative idea.
Indeed. Well, Daniel Pink, who's been a guest on our show and is also a best-selling author of business books, calls yours a truly exhilarating book, The Rare Work That Will Shatter Your Assumptions About How the World Works and Keep Your Brain Firing for Weeks After You've Turned the Last Page. High praise from Daniel Pink. So, Adam Grant, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Now, the book is Give and Take, Why Helping Others Drives Our Success. And let's take a look at the weather now. Cooler, of course, as we all know. High of about 50 today, sunny, low, below freezing, 29 or so, high of 58 tomorrow. Clouds up toward the end of the week, but just a slight chance of snow maybe Tuesday night, Wednesday, could be rain, depending on the temperature. So we will talk about Hispanic entrepreneurship when we come back.
Park City Realty Group is a proud sponsor of KPCW's Mountain Money. This is Mike Mazzoni, principal broker and owner of Park City Realty Group. 100% locally owned and operated, Park City Realty Group provides boutique real estate services to buyers and sellers in the area. 649-1991 or parkcityrealtygroup.com.
Juniper Landing is proud to support our local radio station, KPCW. Juniper Landing is a new, whole ownership townhome community located at the base of Canyons Resort, adjacent to the Waldorf Astoria Park City, with a model open daily. Our website is juniperlandingparkcity.com.
This is Jess Griffiths, attorney in the Park City office of Jones Waldo. We are longtime supporters of KPCW and Mountain Money. I lead our firm's healthcare practice group. There's more information on our website at joneswaldo.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money, and we are going to switch things up. We promised to talk about Latino entrepreneurship, but having a hard time getting a hold of him. But let's switch the topic to Kodiak Cakes. Our other guests this morning were going to talk about Kodiak Cakes and are in the studio now. So we have with us Joel Clark, president, and Cameron Smith, vice president of Kodiak Cakes. And guys, I watched Shark Tank last night on the internet.
All right.
An episode you guys were in, and it's quite entertaining, and we will talk about that experience in a few minutes.
Yeah.
But first, let's talk about Kodiak Cakes. This started out as your mom's recipe.
That's right, it did. In fact, it was my grandpa's recipe before that. And so my mom made us these whole wheat pancakes as we were growing up all the time. And we didn't always love all of the whole wheat things that she made as kids. Uh-huh. Everything we had growing up was healthy, you know. And we didn't always love that, but we loved her pancakes. And so she made these for us all the time growing up. And she always wanted to package it up and turn it into a product that we could sell, you know. So that was kind of her dream. So when I was about 8 years old, she packed up lunch sacks, brown paper lunch sacks on the counter, full of ingredients with whole wheat flour and dried milk and things like that, and hand wrote on the bags how to make her pancakes. And then, you know, we loaded up my red wagon and I went around the neighborhood and sold them. And I sold all of them. Even had a few reorders from some of the neighbors.
So you just tried that once?
Yeah, we just kind
until
of
until you
yeah.
grew up.
That's right. Yeah, it was kind of a one-time thing, one in the summer, something fun to do. And then it was years later in 95 when my older brother John took the recipe and turned it into Kodiak cake. So he actually created a add water only version of the family pancake recipe and created the brand Kodiak Cakes. And then, you know, he and I went out and started selling the product. In fact, one of the first places that we sold it was here in Park City. So he and I each took half of Main and we a side of the street.
We
started at the bottom and we went up and started going. Yeah.
Cold calling.
That's exactly right. Just walked into the gift shops and things like that and started selling.
Boutique pancakes.
Yeah, that's right. That's how it started.
Everybody loves pancakes.
True.
Very fine. So how does a business grow from hand-selling pancake mix by walking down the street? Because now you're in like 7,000 stores.
Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely a process. It has taken a long time. I mean, that was back in the 90s, you know, mid-90s. And after a couple of years, my brother wanted to go back to graduate school. So he turned the business over to me. I was just going to college. And so it was a side job for me for a lot of years, actually. Until we could finally start getting some more grocery stores to carry it. So we realized pretty soon that little gift shops, you know, would be tough to build a decent sized business with. And so we started to approach grocery stores, you know, early 2000s, and finally started getting some to carry it. And so that was kind of a base. We started out in Smith's around here and some of the Associated Foods, little by little started to work our way into store, more and more stores.
That's the hardest thing, isn't it, in this business, is getting into a store, because stores are inundated by people selling products wanting shelf space.
Yeah, you know, that's been probably our hardest part, is getting into stores. I mean, fortunately for us, we've had a lot of lucky breaks. So Joel actually put up an ad at University of Utah. It's about four and a half years ago, and I responded to it, and there's kind of a little small thing going on, and Joel brought me on, and at that time, you know, we had a decent number of grocery stores, and Joel was, you know, he was kind of like, all right, just kind of go for it for sales, you know, let's get into more stores. And I found a contact at Target and was able to get an appointment out there, and I was like, all right, Joel, let's go out to Target. And he wasn't able to make it because he had some previous commitments, so he sent me out by myself on my first real business appointment to go out and present to Target. It has 1,700 stores. So we went out there, and I mean, like I said, the lucky break. We got really, really lucky, and Target brought us into those 1,700 stores a little bit later. So, I mean, we just had a lot of those lucky breaks here and there with different retailers that have helped us get into more retailers.
That had to be a meeting that you came out of and said, oh, my God, what am I going to do now?
Yeah.
It's like, holy crap. So how did you manage to fulfill that, get your production up to the point where you could meet the needs of 1,700 stores? I'm assuming they brought you in gradually, but still, that had to be a somewhat daunting objective to be able to meet whatever you promised them in that meeting. Oh, yeah, no problem. We could do whatever you want.
Yeah. No, I mean, the fortunate thing is, so a lot of, I guess the way grocery stores work is they have reviews. So they have certain times when they review the product, and then after they review it, they have a few months before they bring the product in. And so they'll tell you that, hey, okay, we're going to bring it into this many stores, and then they'll usually give us 2 months to get it ready to ship. So which is good, and that's what Target did, is that they said, okay, we're looking to bring you into this many stores. Here's 2 months so you can get everything produced, and it needs to be shipped by here so you can get ready to fulfill that. Because, I mean, if it were you know, 14 days after, then that would have...
That would have been really hard. I mean, one thing that we did have to do, though, was I had to borrow some money just to fulfill that first order. It was a huge order. And we'd never seen anything like that before, you know? So I had to actually go to my dad and say, hey, Dad, and my dad's not a rich guy, but he had, you know, he had his house paid off and had some money he could access, line of credit and things. And so I had to borrow just to fulfill that order. Luckily, we paid him back. But to get through that was tough. It was.
Hopefully, you paid him back dividend or something, perhaps.
Yeah, that's right. Definitely.
When you go to on Shark Tank and have to give up part of the equity of your company, your dad became your shark.
He did at that time. In a sense. He totally did.
So how have where do you do your pancake mixing?
So we outsource that. Actually, we actually have a company. It's a Utah-based company that makes it for us, which has been great. So it's allowed us to focus on sales and marketing, and you know, allowing them to focus on the manufacturing and the distribution for us. So that's been a good way to go for us. We've always done it that way.
And quality control is something that does your mother or your grandmother keep track of? Taste the pancakes once a week and
absolutely
sure up to snuff?
Yeah, we all kind of do. You know, we all kind of get involved. We all eat it so often that we see what's going on and how it's being made. And so it kind of works well that way.
And you've branched out now. You're not just a pancake mix anymore.
Yeah,
you have stuff to pour on the pancakes.
We have a berry syrup that doesn't sell in a lot of places, but it's a really, really good really good syrup. We sell it on our website, and then we actually developed some minute muffins. I mean, I guess Joel, you can kind of tell about this. Start with
that. This is kind of a cool story.
Well, I'm holding it, and it looks like a dry soup cup that you add hot water to.
It does.
I shake it, and it's a bunch of loose material.
Yeah.
So. And yet the packaging says all this loose material in a soup cup can become a muffin in 1 minute.
That's exactly right. Yeah. It has a dry mix inside of the cup. It's a muffin mix. You add water to a fill line, stir it up, and then put it in the microwave for a minute, and you have a muffin. Now, how we came up with that was I was listening to NPR one day on my way to work, and these two reporters were talking about what could you make in a mug in the microwave at work. And they were talking about all these different things you could make. And one of the things that they made was a chocolate lava cake in the microwave. And I thought, yeah, that sounds kind of cool. So I thought, I wonder if you can make pancakes. And so I went and experimented and put our pancake mix in a mug. And it actually cooked really well. And I was really surprised. So Cameron and I were talking about this one day. And we had been wanting to come up with new products, you know. And so we were talking about this, and Cameron said, you know, I don't know if pancake in a mug sounds as good. What about muffins? And so we're like, hey, that is a cool idea. So we went in the back of the office, and we immediately started experimenting with muffin mix in a cup and microwaved it, and it turned out great. And so that's kind of how the Minute Muffin started. And we thought, you know, this is cool because there's a real trend right now for healthy breakfast on the go. And people are looking for things that are quick and easy that are healthy. And so we kind of hit the trends well. And there's also kind of an interesting trend just online, blogs, among blogs and things where they make mug cakes in a mug. So that's kind of trending too. So this has been really well received.
So yeah, you could put it actually, you pour it out of this container and put it in a mug, and then you'd have a minute muffin in a mug.
You could do it in a mug.
Very alliterative.
I don't know how you get it out of the mug, but that's another story. Okay, let's talk about the evolution of your business. So now you're in Target, you're in 7,000 stores, you're looking to go to the next level. And for that, you need to scale up big time and need a lot of money. Is it? So you wound up on this TV show Shark Tank.
Yeah,
but before going to Shark Tank, have you looked around Utah for either private investors or banks that will just will buy into your dream?
Yeah, it's a great question. We do. We have, and we have some bank financing now, which has helped a lot. I mean, there were for many years we didn't have any, and so that was really challenging. And so we did finally get some bank financing, and that's been very helpful. But we have wanted to scale up faster, and one way to do that is to bring on some capital, and then you can really start to grow. So as we kind of looked around and looked at our options, and we have talked to some local people, but one day back in January, January of last year, actually, Cameron comes up to me and he goes, "Hey, Joel, I'm going to send an email to Shark Tank." And I'm kind of like, "Okay, sounds good. Go ahead." And then, you know what? I never thought about it again. I forgot about it. I had completely forgotten about it. And in fact, to this day, I still don't even know what his email said. I haven't seen the email. And so then we get a call a couple months later on a Thursday night. And, you know, they asked us to put together an audition tape and come in and try to get on the show. And which we almost didn't go.
Right. Yeah, we really debated it because we didn't have a lot of time to make a video, and we weren't quite sure if that would be best and if we should do that, because like Joel said, I mean, we debated on raising money for a long time, and we thought this could be a good avenue. And then after looking at it, we're like, you know what the heck, let's make a video and let's send it off, and who knows what'll come of it. You know, a few weeks later, we started talking to producers. A few weeks after that, they put us on, and so this was last June, actually, when we went in front of the Sharks. So,
and we felt like with Shark Tank, if we could get on, it's not only a potential deal for capital, but there's a lot of exposure there, obviously.
Yeah.
And we felt like that would be great for the brand if we could get that exposure and get sell-through and get people hearing about it and going to the stores to buy it. So that was what was so attractive about that was, you know, not only the money if we did a deal, but also some real, real publicity from that.
And the premise of the show, and I've only watched the episode you were in, but as I get it, the premise of the show is you have five really rich, self-made business people.
Yeah.
And you pitch your pitch to them and see if they want to take a personal stake in your business. And they do a couple of these a week, I guess, and sometimes they buy and sometimes they don't want to buy. And in your case, they wanted to buy into your dream with a personal investment, but they wanted too much of your business, basically.
Yeah. I mean,
And I don't think that's an unusual result anytime you go to a venture capitalist.
That's right. True. I mean, we went into the show pretty firm on what we wanted valuation-wise, and we did feel like they came in too low. So, you know, that was a little, we were a little disappointed about that, but of course we expected them to not take exactly what we had offered. But on the other hand, we did feel like it was too low. We were too far apart, so we couldn't make a deal.
You know, it's interesting, our previous guest, there's an anecdote in his book about a venture capitalist who you guys are probably driving in and didn't get a chance to hear it, but it was about givers and takers. And I might suggest you read his book because I don't know the guy's first name. His last name is Horvick, who's a venture capitalist who has a totally different take on how to go about making deals with people and being a venture capitalist. So it might be worth a look unless you've already found your investor. I think I have $100 that I could throw in, maybe.
Well, you can get a couple cases of pancake mix. I think that's about
definitely,
it.
Definitely.
Well, talk more about the Shark Tank experience. So what is it you were seeking, and what were you willing to give up to get it? And why were you seeking the capital you were after in that show?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, so we were seeking $500,000, and we're giving up 10% of the business at that point. And for us, we were
Means math-wise, you think this is a $5 million business.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, we were on track this last year to hit $5 million in sales, and so that's kind of how we valued it. And based on consumer packaged good products are usually sold for around 1 to 1.5 times of current revenue and projected revenue. So we... But we needed the money a lot to hire more people. I mean, right now we have 6 people. We have 4 full-time people and 2 part-time people working for us. And if we had the money, we could hire a lot more salespeople. Joel and I, we do all the sales with all the grocery stores that we work with. And so to hire more people, we could really expand that, get into more stores and help launch all these new products and meet with stores, be able to buy more inventory. It would really, really help.
And are you finding other sources for it?
For capital?
For the $500,000.
Yeah, you know what? It's funny. We have had a lot of people that have reached out to us after the show and have said, hey, I'd love to talk to you about your deal, you know, that type of thing. And so we're a little bit on the fence about when or, you know, if and when we would raise money. And I think a big part of it is to find the right partner is a huge thing for us. Somebody who has experience would be really helpful because, I mean, we're blazing a good trail. But someone who's been there and who has built a business in our industry could be really helpful. So we're still pursuing it, but we're not like anxious. We're okay. But to really grow, we think that some capital could really help.
Now when did Shark Tank air?
So it aired just a week and a half ago.
Yeah, it was on the 4th.
Yeah,
can you tell yet if it's resulted in just the? I mean, it's just fabulous national exposure for one product. Can you tell yet if it's moving more product on the shelves you're on?
Yeah, we heard from Target, for example, that over the weekend after it aired, that we had done, I believe it was about a 13 times increase over what we typically do in a week. Wasn't that right, Cameron?
Yeah, we sold out after a few days. We had to expedite a few orders this last week. I mean, they ordered just last week alone over $100,000 worth of product just to get stuff on the shelf.
Our website crashed that night because we had increased our bandwidth, but it just still wasn't enough. So, I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, and we had a lot of just orders on our website. I mean, it was pretty cool. It really was.
That should certainly pique the interest of other investors, I would think, when you see that kind of a bump.
Yeah, yeah.
And we'll kind of see over the next few months kind of what happens too, because a lot of it was people reacting right after seeing it. But this might be, you know, someone who goes to the store in a month, sees Kodiak cakes on the shelves, like, oh, I thought I saw the Shark Tank. Now I'll try it. So, I mean, I think the effect will kind of last a little bit longer. So we'll kind of watch that.
Okay, so never having been on a reality show other than TV news.
That's about as real as it gets.
That's right.
What was the process? Where did they tape it? You march out there, and I watched you. You guys were really self-confident.
Which is good that translated over. We were nervous as heck.
Yeah, we were. Yes, we were.
It's like privately, were there butterflies?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I remember just thinking, oh, I've got to make sure that I'm not sweating too much. And you know, they can't see that. But it was really intense. We were in the Shark Tank for about 45 minutes or so, and that only gets edited down to what you see on TV, so which was maybe 10 minutes or so. But we were in there for a long time, and it's really back and forth, and it's intense. I mean, they're firing questions at you, and you have to try to answer them. And sometimes one will ask a question, and then the next person will ask another one without giving you a chance to respond to the first one. And so it was an intense experience. It was down in Columbia Picture Studios, just out in L.A. And so we were down there for almost a week, and we had a few days of downtime before we actually went to do our pitch. And so we were down there. We prepared. One thing we really did try to do is to prepare well. And so we spent a lot of time just role-playing and asking each other tons of questions and over and coming up with everything we could think of that we might be asked. And we studied our numbers. I mean, we tried to go in with as well-prepared as we possibly could. And I think that helped. It really did help.
Well, Lowry and I are obviously not as intimidating as the Shark Tank guys because you seem very confident and relaxed here with us. I just want to ask one question. Where does Kodiak come from? Where did you get that name?
Oh, well, we grew up hearing stories. My dad lived in Alaska when he was 18 on a survey crew. So he was out in the mountains doing all summer long for a couple of years. So he told us while we were growing up, he would tell us stories about the Kodiak bears all the time. And when my brother was naming it and coming up with the brand, he and my other brother were kind of talking about it and brainstorming, and one brother said, hey, why don't you call it Bear Cakes? Because they wanted to do something rustic, kind of outdoors, a little bit kind of Western and authentic. And so then my other brother said, hey, I like that. What about Kodiak Cakes? And it just stuck.
Indeed. And stick to your ribs good. So I think I haven't had any myself yet.
Well, we brought you a few cases, so you guys can try.
We see some samples arrived with you, so we'll give it a try this week. What is the, you know, this seems very similar to another story in the next valley, in the Heber Valley. Bear Creek Kitchens started out with a woman selling. She started with a wassail recipe at Christmas time and then went into dry soup mixes. The company grew leaps and bounds, became huge for the Heber Valley. But at some point, you either go big or go home. And at that point, a bigger company acquires and takes it nationally and is well capitalized and has all the distribution. Is that your ultimate goal, to grow this to the point that someone bigger comes along?
Yeah, I mean, that's a tempting thing to build it up and maybe sell it someday. I guess we don't have a real defined exit plan yet. I mean, I think our goal is to continue to grow and to really build, because we have a great base now. We want to be in, you know, 15, 20,000 grocery stores in the next 4 years. So we are looking to do that. So we'll see. I mean, we don't have a real defined exit plan yet. Well, I guess we'll see, but we do want to build it as big as we can, though. We want it to really get out there.
Based in Utah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Funny thing is, we actually live in the Heber Valley, Cameron and I do. We both live in Midway.
Okay.
So we know the Bear Creek story well.
You know
well.
The Bear Creek story, and Bear Creek is everywhere now. You can go to anywhere in the country and find Bear Creek products.
Yeah.
And that's what... being bought out at some point allowed that brand to go nationwide.
That's true.
Well, just a final question, I guess. What do Mom and Dad think about the maiden in their kitchen product reaching network television and 7,000 stores?
Hey, they love it. You know, my dad actually worked with me on this business for about 3 years. He and I together before Cameron came, when we were still pretty small. And so he's got a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in this. My mom's got a lot of blood, sweat, and tears in this. And so it's pretty cool for all of us to see this actually working. It's pretty fun to see it happen. I mean, after so much work that you put into it, and to see it actually starting to kind of work, that's pretty satisfying.
Yeah, that's, I think, without an exit strategy, this is probably the part you're going to enjoy the most. So you'll have to kind of let it run its course and
that's
see where you end up. I mean,
yeah.
It's got to be exciting to be able to take and grow your business and know it's all because of you and not because some mega conglomerate has come in.
That's true. Yeah.
Well, congratulations to you two, especially Joel Clark, president of Kodiak Cakes, and Cameron Smith, vice president, and both of you, the chief salesman, and good of you for going in the Shark Tank and turning down the sharks. They wanted to make a deal with you, but you didn't like the terms and you turned them down. And those guys really did behave like sharks. They were cutting each other off, telling each other to shut up. And
that's right.
Very fun.
Definitely takers, not givers.
Okay. Yeah. Well, our guests, Joel Clark and Cameron Smith from Kodiak Cakes, thanks for joining us. And we'll be back to wrap up Mountain Money after this.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having us.
This is Ryan Hoffman, branch manager at Mountain West Bank.
And Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender, sponsor of Mountain Money on KPCW.
We offer several products and services for individuals and businesses, including deposit and loan solutions.
Mountain West Bank, Kearns Boulevard, next to the theater, 649-3369.
Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law. LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, mortgage assistant for home purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to Mountain Money. A few reminders. Tomorrow, it's This Green Earth, and Chris Cherniak will be here, and he's actually asked me to co-host, and we will be talking about plans to build a 2-megawatt solar power plant in the southern part of the state. It's by Rocky Mountain Power, and they will be investing heavily in solar, and that's interesting news, and we'll talk about that on This Green Earth. Also coming up next week, we will have on Mountain Money speakers from the Zions Bank International Trade and Business Conference. Also, Chris Bender, who's with Paul Wyatt Designs. They build fancy wine racks. And we'll talk food with the executive chef of the St. Regis. Alex, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Larry. I appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk to two great guests. Three, actually, counting Cameron.
Indeed. So thanks for listening. This is Mountain Money, and this is KPCW Park City.